Hello and welcome along to the Property Academy podcast by Opus Partners. I'm your host, Steve McKnight.
And I'm Andrew Nicholl.
And today on the show, we're talking about how do you protect yourself when things go wrong and how do you use look-through companies and trusts and different structures to make sure that you're protected. Now, to walk us through this, we're joined by Matthew Gilligan, who is the Managing Director at Gilligan Rowan Associates, or GRA. And the really cool thing is we were recently, Andrew and I, at an event with Steve Goody. And we were sitting down and we were watching some people speak, and then Matt got up. And I think it must have been the most interesting accounting presentation I have seen in a long, long time. And so I thought we've got to get him on the show and talk about some case studies about how can investors protect themselves when things go wrong. Now, Matt, let's start off with what have you seen go wrong when it comes to property investors? Like, what is the worst situation you've seen that someone would want to avoid?
Well, firstly, thanks to both of you for inviting me along. It's great to hook up with Opus Partners. GRA, we're chartered accountants. We specialise in tax legal structures. We also broadly look after the compliance of clients. So we have a tax team, which I sit in. And in that team, we have lawyers. We set up trusts and set up commercial structures for our clients. So it's from that background that I speak. And in the client base, we've got over 10,000 entities that we act for. And every year something goes wrong for somebody, if not one family, two families. And I wouldn't say it's from any particular area, but, you know, Building Act claims, you have 10 years liability under the Building Act. It fairly quickly attaches to the director. Relationship property claims, spouses that are claiming assets that they weren't supposed to be able to claim. Just general business failure. The directors get sued for reckless trading or trading while insolvent. Bank foreclosure and personal guarantees. The source of liability is as wide and as long as the day is long. And I guess what we say is when you're setting up your tax and legal structures, planning for success in our world is actually planning for failure. And we say to our clients, you should, if you're going to get into asset protection, ask yourself what you would do today if you knew that in 12 months' time you were going to go bankrupt. Set the bar high, because if you knew that you're going to go bankrupt in 12 months, you would do everything you could today to protect yourself. And I think that a lot of lawyers and accountants are quite lackadaisical in the way they set up structures. They bang a trust in place and assume that that's the end of it. But there's a lot more to asset protection than just, you know, putting a trust in place. You've got to look at what happens at the company level if the company fails. And something that you would have heard me talking about at Steve's event is when a trust puts money into a company, if that company fails, you lose your money to the creditors. But if you put a security instrument over the line from the trust to the company, a general security agreement, then you rank first ahead of IRD, ahead of all the creditors, you get your money back. So that's what I mean about setting the bar high. It's not just set up a trust and it's done. It's look ahead 12 months and make sure that if you're going bankrupt in 12 months, you've done everything you can do today to protect yourself. Don't tackle it with a feather, hit it with a hammer, do it properly.
And you said that you've got a team of lawyers as well. Is that unusual for an accounting firm?
Well, if you specialise in tax like we are, tax is law. And we work, you know, on commercial structures, so we set up trusts and companies and assist clients with things that are sort of in the middle between accounting firms and law firms, and we collaborate with law firms all over the country, really. Yeah, so I think it is unusual for an accounting practice, but not a tax practice.
Okay, and I remember you telling a story about a bankrupt farmer's son. What was the situation there?
So, well, it's sort of teasing out this reason why you set up trusts and really demonstrates how average some of the planning that is done out there actually is. And I was talking about a farm in Cromwell that I bought, would have been 2006, so it's a while ago now. But I bought it off a farmer who went bankrupt. And actually, the official assignee had stepped into his shoes. And he had inherited the farm while he was a bankrupt from his father. So I bought the farm off the OA because his father didn't simply set up a trust and leave it to a trust for his son. So all his father needed to do was construct a will that said he created a trust after his death for his son. And his father no doubt would have known his son was a bankrupt, or his son could have told his father. And then I would have bought the farm off the trust and he would have got the money. And it just shows how short-sighted some of the planning around the town is when you know, somebody gives their farm away because they haven't communicated with their lawyers and thought ahead.
So let me just get this straight in my head. So there was a farmer, you know, assumedly quite a rich farmer, who owns this big plot of land. Now, he carks it, but the issue is that his son's bankrupt. So the son inherits the farm, but then he has to sell that and he doesn't get any of the money for it because he's bankrupt. So it's got to go to the people that he owed money to. But had the dad put in his will that, no, the farm does not go to the son, the farm goes to a trust that the son might control or be the beneficiary of, then the son who was bankrupt could still have kept that farm and, if decided to sell it, could have still had the benefit of that money. But unfortunately, he didn't in the end.
Yeah, well said. That's exactly the situation.
How amazing that you can plan out your structures like this to really, I want to say, rot the tax system,
well,
but I'm not
going to
do
no,
that.
Protect appropriately.
Yeah, to protect yourself.
But that's not tax. He's gone bankrupt for whatever reason. And, you know, that's not his asset. It's his father's asset. So it is right and proper that his father can direct where that wealth would go and allow for the timing of it. There's nothing improper about what his father could have done. That's his farm. He chooses whether he gives it to the official assignee to satisfy his son's creditors or directs it to go into a trust for when his son comes out of bankruptcy and can then live on the farm and work on the farm. And it was just a lack of foresight on his son and his father's part that they lost the farm, you know.
And there's probably a good lesson in that for a lot of people, in that even if your kids aren't bankrupt, you might want to set it up this way anyway, so that if in 10 years it turns out that they are bankrupt, then you can protect it in that way.
Or even just a relationship, right? Because if you end up passing on and then leaving a property to your kids and they're married to someone that then decides they want to take half of it, you're exposed there. Is that right, ma'am?
Yeah, I mean, there's many reasons you set up a trust and you just put your finger on two of them. Firstly, relationship property claims. You know, somebody's coming in, marrying kids, 40% of relationships fail. Your kids' assets, 40% of them will get taken unless you do something about it. So if you've got some wealth in your family, you're passing it down to your kids. Generally, you'll have your trust specify some trusts for the kids. So, you know, the parents' trust will break into separate trusts for each of the children. The children then inherit via a trust. That makes it much harder for the spouse of the children to claim against those assets because trust assets are not relationship property. Actually, you got to watch it with relationship property. It's a slippery slope. And I don't know if the judiciary is increasingly left-leaning, but they are finding mechanisms to open trusts up. You're much better with a trust than without one. I often hear in the media noise about trusts being a problem. That's usually relationship property lawyers, and they hate them because they make their lives so difficult trying to break into them. And so a lot of the reasons to not form a trust are actually from people whose job it is to try and break into them and find them problematic. Whereas in our client base, every year someone goes broke. We've never seen one of our trusts get turned over. And if you do all the basics right, which we'll discuss shortly, your trust will be quite robust. But relationship property is one of those things where a trust is a good thing for you, good for your kids. In addition, you should have a relationship property agreement signed off with the spouse. And a relationship property agreement, or a Section 21 agreement as it's called, coupled with a trust is a very powerful thing to protect assets. But not very romantic.
Well, thank God for that, because I'm about to set up a trust and a relationship property agreement. So that's a beautiful thing. So let's talk about some of those basics then about setting it up so that my trust can't get broken into.
Well, the last thing you want to be is a sham trust, which is a trust that's not a trust. And I've read a couple of cases where the judge essentially says, this is yet another example of a family principal who set up a trust, wants all the benefits of a trust, asset protection, tax benefits, but is not willing to do anything related to the role of being a trustee of a trust. By example, if you're a trustee in a trust, you should understand your duties as a trustee. You should understand what assets and liabilities you have and what the entitlements of the beneficiaries are. And annually, when you're working with the trust assets, you should be referencing your decision making to the interests of the beneficiaries. And so that's the mindset of a trustee. Now, okay, might sound like a bit of bullshit, but if you don't do that in your minutes and resolutions and your paperwork, you're setting yourself up to have a sham allegation against the trust. Sham allegations normally come from a spouse trying to break into a trust saying, hey, that's a separate relationship probably, but you haven't actually behaved as a trustee properly. So it's not a trust, it's a sham trust. And then the assets fall out of the trust and become available for the creditors to claim against or the spouse to claim against. So I guess what I'm saying is avoid being a sham trust by doing your minutes on any major transaction going on. Make sure you've got all your paperwork in place, your gifting, your paperwork for transferring assets into the trust. If you have an independent trustee, that's a really good thing. An independent trustee is a third-party trustee that sits in the trust that's not a beneficiary. And that's really powerful to prove that a trust is validly used. But if you don't consult them, it's evidence that the trust is a sham. So you got to talk to them and minute the resolution to get them to sign it. And actually, what I would say is for your family home, it's sort of set and forget. You put your home into the trust, your independent trustee signs off that it's transferred in there. You never have to minute it again. It's done. It's set and forget. For business trusts, it's a bit more active. And actually, an independent trustee can be a problem because you're not going to talk to them about the minutiae of the activity in the trust, and they can actually end up setting the trust up to fail. And that's where you could use a thing called a corporate trustee, where you put a company in as a trustee, and it solely runs the trust, and then you as the director handle the day-to-day transactions using your directorship, and you only consult the independent trustee for major transactions.
Okay. So there are three main things in there. First of all, making sure that we're doing our minutes correctly, we're doing our paperwork, and obviously our accountants and lawyers are going to help us with that. The second thing is to get an independent trustee in there and make sure that they're signing off those major transactions. And then if it was a business trust, considering or getting some advice from an accountant about using a corporate trustee.
A corporate trustee is simply a company that acts as a trustee, and it's a different governance model, Ed. So if the three of us formed a trust for, let's say that we're going to do a JV together, so the three of us form a trust, if we don't consult each other on all of the transactions, it's evidence that we're not functioning as a perfect trust. So for example, Ed, let's just say we're your co-trustees, that's your asset, and then you do everything you want to in the trust, you buy and sell assets, and you don't speak to Andrew or I, then you've made the trust a sham. But if we had a single company as the trustee, and you were the director, and the three of us were the shareholders, through your directorship, you run that trust. That's exactly how corporate governance works. The directors make the decisions. And you revert to the shareholders for participation in major transactions or significant transactions. Then what you've done is you've created a governance model that doesn't force you to talk to Andrew and I. You can handle the day-to-day stuff while we sign off the larger stuff. So it's sort of, it's a better governance model that doesn't set you up to have an automatic sham.
Yeah, well, it sounds like I need to read. Now, what you've got a book, like a textbook that you've written specifically about trusts. What's that? Is it Family Trusts 101?
Janet Zukoa, ex-partner of GRA, wrote that, yeah.
Yeah, so I'll have to give that a read.
It's a good book. And my Tax Structures 101 is pretty good on the stuff too. It's on the GRA website, gra.co.nz.
Now, one of the other things that struck me from your speech the other day, you're telling a story, and I've relayed this terribly to a couple of people since, about some people that had some kids and then they ended up separating, or someone passed away and then they had other kids. Tell us the story about the Magenta children.
So the topic is a blended family. When you're setting up your tax and legal structures, if you're second time around in your marriage and you've got children to prior partners, a problem emerges in that the last to die gets to decide what happens to the money. So if you've got three kids and your partner's got three kids and you die first, your partner's got six kids, will they give your three kids their half share? And so if they are the appointor and solely in charge of the trust, which was set up during your lifetime, will they do the right thing by your children? What if your children don't like them and they are abusive or not friendly with them? Will they still do the right thing with your kids? Might be your kid's fault, but, you know, these are thoughts that you want to think about when you're setting structures up. And it's called the blended family issue. And the example that you speak of, Andrew, is one of our clients, and it goes like the spouse one married spouse two. Spouse one had children. spouse two had children, they got together, they had children. So now you had three layers of children. Spouse one's children to their prior relationship, spouse two's children to their prior relationship, and they had kids together. And then spouse one died. And then spouse two married spouse three, who also had children to a prior relationship, spouse three, and then had children with spouse two. And then spouse two died.
Unlucky.
So spouse one's children, and including the children to spouse two, got handed over to spouse three, and you had, you know, many layers of kids in there from different families. And the question is, would spouse three look after the children of spouse one, given that they didn't even know them? And I don't need to answer the question other than it demonstrates the point that if you throw it all in one trust, you can actually end up disinheriting your kids or setting your kids up to be disinherited by, you know, the relationship failing with your subsequent spouse that survives you. So yeah, it's something to think about. And actually the moral of the story is, for blended families, consider seriously having two trusts, trust A and trust B. And so, for example, a family home could be held between the two trusts. And if spouse one dies, they leave a life interest for spouse two to live in it. They can sell the house, buy another house, whatever. But on their death, the money goes back to their kids of their trust.
It must be fascinating as we get into more and more blended families, you know, divorce becomes reasonably common and then people, you know, marry up for a second time. And in this situation, you've got three adults with five different sets of kids, and then the assets get passed between the adults because if you haven't set it up correctly, because when you die, it just goes to your partner and then it goes to somebody else's partner. And then you do start worrying, well, what happens to my kids? Well, if they're my kids, probably they wouldn't get anything because they're not going to be very nice. And Matt, the last thing I want to ask before we wrap up this episode, interest deductibility, that's about to come back in, and the tax rate for trusts is about to change. Does this change how investors should be structuring their investment properties?
I think every household is different. It's very hard to say from a generic perspective what's the best tax or legal structure, because every household is quite different. Interest non-deductions were creating taxable profits out of negative cash flow, weren't they? So you would have a negative cash flow, but then you'd take half the interest away and you'd be tax positive. It was an envy tax, an ideological tax, capital gains tax and drag. So that's being washed away and we get the full deductibility back. And so the net cash flow minus depreciation is the taxable income. And what that's going to do, especially with interest rates being so high, is it's going to push a lot of households into a loss situation. As you know, residential losses are ring-fenced. So in that regard, there's no change other than there'll be welcomed tax relief because you won't be paying tax on negative cash flow, which is the situation we've got now. You've got negative cash flow and you have to pay tax on half the interest. So it's not really going to change things because you can't use the losses. But, you know, you raise a good point. What is the best structure in this environment? If a household is tax positive, we generally will look to see if a trust is going to benefit them, because income spreading is, you know, a huge advantage if your household can take advantage of it. So income spreading is where you put your income into a trust and then you can allocate income across the beneficiaries of the trust. It's quite lawful. It's why trusts are created. It's not tax avoidance. The first $14,000 of income is taxed at 10.5%. Then up to $48,000, it's taxed at 17.5%. So if Andrew's got a freehold property in his name and he's paying tax on 180 grand or more, he's paying tax at 39, can transfer that property into a trust, take the income of it, spread it across his children, spouse. If they're not earning, then they're using these much lower rates. And, you know, that's the concept of income splitting. The kids have to be 16 or older to be a beneficiary of a trust to get a valid distribution. And if the spouse is not working, then or not being paid, then it's low hanging fruit, easy to pick. Paying your spouse as a sole trader, you need IRD's permission. They generally don't give it unless there's a very valid reasons. Generally, a sole trader or personal ownership of an asset is a second class structure. We wouldn't recommend that. So it really comes down to trust or company. And then if you're going to be in a company, is it a look-through company? why would you want to be looked through if you can't use the losses? You probably prefer to have the option of the marginal tax rate at 28%, or the company tax rate at 28%, rather than having any potential future income flow through the company, a look-through company, to the individual shareholders, and then get taxed at 39% potentially. So most of the time we have, in the last few years, we've been working with ordinary companies owned by trusts or direct ownership into trusts, and LTCs have gone out of vogue because the ability to have the income flow through the LTC or the loss flow through the LTC is of no benefit with loss ring fencing. As I said, you know, speaking generically about these structures is difficult because every household's different, and you've really got to have fact-specific questions to, and then you craft what structure works best for the household.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest things. There's no one-size-fits-all because, you know, you might have blended families, you might own a business, you might have some properties making a profit, some properties making a loss. So that's where getting advice is important if you want to maximise your protection and minimise your tax.
Right, let's wrap it up there. But please don't forget to rate, review and subscribe to the podcast. It really does help us get the message out to more people. And hey, if you want to check out Gilligan Rowan Associates, head to gra.co.nz. And while you're there, make sure you check out Matt's book, Property 101. It is one of our top picks for property investment books in New Zealand. Thanks for listening to the Property Academy podcast by Opus Partners. I'm your host, Stephen Knight.
And I'm Andrew Nicholl.
We're going to be back here tomorrow with even more daily strategies, tactics, and insights to help you get the most out of the New Zealand property market. Until next time.